Stand by for music. Roger, music. Go music.
Go for music.
All right, hang on. All right, go Kai. Hey, everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. Camera turn. This is Make Me Smart. Go to camera
B. We can host, we can direct. Oh, my God. They had to just let us do
right?
this whole thing.
I mean,
oh my
we're
God.
Just like a two-person operation. Right now, the whole control room full of people is like, oh, really? Are you? Double barrel people.
Yeah, they're just
that's when you flip people off
right?
with both fingers,
oh
in
God.
Case you were wondering. This is Make Me Smart, where we get so smart about how to properly flip off your producers.
Yes.
Also tech, the economy and culture, and where none of us is as smart as all of us, and we are off to a smart start, I know.
So we are here, kind of. It's another pre-tape, a respin, kind if of. You will. We are back next week, live and in person. For now, though, one more favorite episode from 2019. Also, your predictions about what you think is going to happen in 2020. And if you've listened to the last two episodes, which I, of course, encourage you to do, you'll hear me and Molly laying out what we think is going to happen.
I'm telling you, this is a trifecta for a road trip, is what this is.
Oh, good idea.
Yep. The interview, also, I'm still in my Christmas sweater, in case you're wondering. Still. YouTube. The interview you will hear today is actually one of my favorites. It is still, fortunately or unfortunately, very relevant.
Yeah.
Facebook, Twitter, and other online platforms have, of course, maybe you've heard, been criticized for failing to adequately moderate the content on their platforms, whether it comes to hate speech or other inflammatory content or even political advertising. They have generally been able to get away with this argument that they are not liable for what users post on their sites. Now, as the 2020 election gets closer, this obviously becomes a bigger and bigger issue. In October, Facebook caused everyone to completely freak out for refusing to take down political ads that contain factual errors or even fact check them at all. Google then decided to limit ad targeting. So they said that ads can no longer be specifically targeted to people based on voting records or party affiliation. And Twitter just got rid of them completely.
I know. Well, but then got itself all wrapped up around the axle about what's an actual political ad versus campaign ad and what's an issue.
Of course, which is why Facebook doesn't want to touch
exactly.
it. Yeah.
Zuckerberg went to Congress a number of weeks/months ago to talk about Libra, that digital currency that they're trying to get going. But that got completely upstaged when Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez started going after the CEO of Facebook about content moderation in that political sense. And here's the way that one played out.
Would I be able to run advertisements on Facebook targeting Republicans in primary saying that they voted for the Green New Deal? I mean, if you're not fact-checking political advertisements, I'm just trying to understand the bounds here. What's fair
Congresswoman,
game?
Congresswoman, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I think
so
probably.
You don't know if I'll be able to do that?
I think probably.
Do you see a potential problem here with a complete lack of fact-checking on political advertisements?
Well, Congresswoman, I think lying is bad, and I think if you were to run an ad that had a lie, that would be bad. That's different from it being, in our position, the right thing to do to prevent your constituents or people in an election from seeing that you had lied.
For the life of me, I don't understand why that company keeps trotting him out like that. Truly.
Yep.
He's his own
don't
worst enemy.
Don't let him talk anymore.
It's unbelievable.
Well, I know. And how are you going to convince people that this is a well-considered policy when you show up in front of Congress like the kid who didn't study for the test?
Yeah. Honestly.
I mean, if you don't have an answer, you don't know what. I'm just saying, this is why I made that somewhat crazy-sounding prediction.
Yeah,
I still think you're high.
Mark Zuckerberg
is going
to resign. I still think you're high. It's
I probably am.
You've had a high going for 3 weeks now.
Now, the other thing we should point out again is that because we did record this in advance, there is the small possibility that Facebook has already changed this policy because everyone around them now is saying like, we don't want that.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, there's actually a great context to be had in this interview we're going to air here again.
Yep.
Because it goes back to the foundational document, if you will, of kind of where we are. It's a 1996 law called the Communications Decency Act, specifically Section 230 of that law.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Section 230 is the one that essentially says you're not responsible for things that users post on your site. To understand what it's all about, we had this great conversation with this guy, Jeff Kossoff. He is a professor of cybersecurity law at the U.S. Naval Academy, and he wrote a book, the book, pretty much, about this, called The 26 Words That Created the internet. And so here is that interview with Jeff Kossoff.
Jeff, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
All right, the 26 words, Jeff, hit it.
No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information created by another information content provider.
Boom.
That is the relevant section of the Communications Decency Act of 1996, Section 230, which is how we got to where we are, right?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. So to understand how we got to where we are, we actually have to go far back beyond earlier than 1996. And that's really the whole reason why Congress even passed Section 230. And the reason is that there was this weird rule under the First Amendment that said distributors of other people's content can't be held liable unless they know or should have known that that content was defamatory or illegal. And that worked well for bookstores that were selling books and so forth. But when we got to the internet, what happened was we had these services that, frankly, my students have never even heard of called CompuServe and Prodigy that took very different approaches as to how to provide services online. So CompuServe was like the Wild West, and it did not do any moderation. It let its users post anything they want, see anything they want. Prodigy wanted to be family friendly, so they had user policies, content policies, moderators, and they both end up getting sued in the early 90s for defamation. CompuServe ends up having its lawsuit dismissed because the court says you're more like a bookstore, so you didn't know, you shouldn't have known. Prodigy, on the other hand, was treated like a publisher because it moderated. So Prodigy was found that it could be on the hook for up to $200 million for a defamatory post. So Congress passed Section 230 to provide this very broad immunity for platforms because it found that there was this really perverse incentive that they were creating, that the law created for these platforms, saying if you don't moderate, you'll get more protection. And that's where Section 230 comes in. And that's when we're talking about publishers right. versus platforms. Right. You really have to understand the real distinction. You have to go back before that.
Mm-hmm. Well, because what the law aimed to do was say, there's going to be some protection for you if you engage with this content in some way. If you do basic moderating, but you can't catch everything. Right, then you won't necessarily be liable for the stuff you didn't catch. And you really write in this book, and we've been talking about this for a while, like this is the, you say, the 26 words that created the internet. This is why Reddit, Google, Twitter, AOL, YouTube have not been sued out of existence many times over. This is why we have the internet economy that we have today.
That's exactly right. So when you look at where the most successful platforms are based, I mean, most of them are based in the United States, and it's really not an accident. It's a large part is because of Section 230. The United States really has the broadest protection for platforms for user-generated content in the world. If you look at Europe, for example, you just cannot see the same business model working in Europe as it does in the United States because they would be liable for so much of what their users post.
So I'm wary of me being the rain on the parade guy here. But 1996, 23 years ago, as you say in the book, at the time that 230 was passed, only 40 million people on the planet had internet access. Here we are now, 2019, 11 gajillion people are online, and yet we are still using a law from prehistory, really, to regulate what happens on the internet. Discuss.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the criticism of Section 230, I actually agree with quite a bit of it. I have mixed feelings about its utility currently. I think the big problem that we have right now is we've really built this entire industry, this mm-hmm. trillion-dollar industry, on the shoulders of Section right. 230. So I think, but there still were harms back then. There were very real harms that were being caused by user content. The second case ever decided with Section 230 in 1997 was a case where a mother sued AOL mm-hmm. because AOL's chat rooms were being used to market child pornography mm-hmm. that had her son in it. I mean, those are tough cases even back then. So, I mean, yes, there are really terrible harms that have come up in a lot of recent Section 230 cases. But I think we also want to keep in mind there's been this sort of this trade-off that's existed since the beginning, since Section 230 was passed.
Hmm. Well, and it seems fair to say, you know, what's interesting is that this particular regulation did give platforms pretty broad latitude to moderate content. Like, it specifically said, you have this latitude to be in there, to set up filters, to, as a private company, exercise your right to create the kind of environment that you want to create, and you still won't get sued for missing some stuff. And yet they didn't. And it feels like that's a decision that is worth discussing. Why does Twitter have such a hands-off approach? Why has it taken YouTube so long to say, you know, we think that we're going to take stronger action against certain kinds of videos? And I get that censorship's a hard game, but what's interesting is that they did take such a hands-off approach for so long when it seems like they were better protected.
I think there was a laziness for quite some time, and part of it might have had to do with Section 230, that they just didn't need to be so proactive. Another part of it is that we, and it's hard to really paint with a broad brush of platforms, because there really are more platforms than just Facebook and YouTube and Google. But they are the big ones. And I think the bigger problem that I at least have had with them is that only until recently, until the past few years when they've really gotten criticism, they were so secretive about a lot of these practices. They would have these broad policies, but there was no real transparency. I mean, in my capacity at the Naval Academy, I work with intelligence agencies as well for other types parts of my research. And I'll say, I often felt like I was dealing with intelligence agencies when I was dealing with the large platforms. They were so secretive. And they've stopped doing that, and they've started explaining some of the approaches that they've taken. And some of them have actually been very thoughtful. But I think transparency is key if they want to be able to preserve the current business model that they have.
Do you think they've got that the necessary transparency now? I mean, Molly and I have talked about this a lot, right? I mean, Facebook's answer to any problem that comes up with Facebook is always more Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's getting better. It's not anywhere near where I would want to see. And again, this goes far beyond Facebook.
Yeah.
My concern, I think even if you got rid of Section 230, they will weather whatever storm comes to them. I worry about the smaller platforms that want to be the next Facebook and Google. I don't think they have the same clout, the same ability to help craft whatever rules come out. So, but yeah, I mean, I think that there needs to be far more transparency about the decisions they make. But we also have to always keep in mind that moderation is really hard. Content that someone might find to be objectionable and terrible and harmful, someone else might find to be their free speech. And then you have a private company in the middle making the decision of, well, what am I going to allow it or not allow it? They're going to get criticized by someone.
Yeah, but sorry, it's Congress, as you write, Congress decided to let the platforms have this power, and the platforms have proven themselves not up to the challenge. And the idea that we now have to count on Mark Zuckerberg or Jack Dorsey to defend free speech at the same time as they're running a for-profit company that controls information flow to billions of people seems problematical.
Yeah, there definitely are some problems with the model. So, I mean, Section 230 was built on this theory of user empowerment, meaning that users would determine the community standards that they want, and they would walk away from platforms if those platforms were not generally meeting those standards. Now, the big problem with that is you now have these massive companies, and it's hard to walk away from Facebook if you want to connect with your friends, because, or if you want to log on to a service that uses Facebook login, or all of those things. So I think that that's the bigger problem. And I'm not ready to pass judgment on yes or no, is this a good or bad moderation practice? Because frankly, and I mean, I've been researching in this area for years now. I still don't have the greatest idea. I mean, we get bits and pieces, but I think we need to have a lot more light on what they're doing, and also have it more collaborative and figure out what can they be doing better. And I think, frankly, a lot of the recent debates might be pushing them in this direction, because it's really existential for a lot of the platforms.
It is. Well, like you said, though, okay, let's say that altering, you know, fundamentally, I think we have this question, which is, do we need to change Section 230, or do these big platforms need to change the way they operate? Because like you said, if we alter 230 in a way that makes it harder for the next Facebook to be built, But Facebook, Twitter, and Google are fine and able to absorb the blow and hire more moderators and throw some more AI on it, then have we just essentially thrown the baby out with the bathwater?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And that's why I think I'm really glad that there are a lot of these discussions about Section 230. I started pitching this book back in 2015, and I'll just tell you, publishers, many publishers were like, what are you talking? What's a decency? What, 1996? Why do you want to write about this? So I'm glad, really glad that people are really interested in this now. But I think what we need to do is take the next step and say, okay, if we're going to make changes to Section 230 or repeal it, what will the internet look like? Or what changes can we make that would achieve the desired benefits without as many costs? And I'm not hearing that nuanced discussion as much. I'm hoping that we can start having it rather than just say, Section 230 is bad, let's get rid of it. I think we need to go a bit deeper than that.
Do you think Congress, you know, yes, Congress doesn't write all the laws, but eventually they have to vote. Does Congress have the capacity? Do they understand enough to be able to fine-tune Section 230, right? Because it's not sacrosanct, right? The First Amendment is not an unlimited right, and 230 is not an unlimited clause. Do they have the ability to fine-tune it in a way that will do the most good with the least harm?
I think so. I mean, I think they passed it. They, I'm not entirely sure, based on my research at least. I think that there were only a handful of people in Congress who were even paying attention to it at the time when it passed. But I think they do. I mean, I know Congress gets a really bad rap for its technological expertise, especially in light of some of the higher profile hearings where there have been some comments that some senators and members of Congress have made. But I do think that, I mean, this really does come down to some basic equities here about what are our values for free speech versus privacy versus even security. And I think that there are really some tough policy choices. And one thing I remind the platforms is that Section 230, by and large, is not required by the First Amendment. So Congress, with one vote, could get rid of Section 230. This is not a constitutional mandate. And so I think that the platforms, that when I say they need to be transparent, they need to really demonstrate what is the value of this really extraordinary immunity that Congress has provided.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they're worried about it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So they know, but are they counting on the lack of understanding?
I think so. I mean, I think there just might be some belief in the power of entropy and the power of gridlock. I think I've either been a journalist or a lawyer or a professor in D.C. for 15 years now, and I see a lot of ideas come here and then they don't materialize because they just kind of get stuck, or they end up getting added, in the worst case scenario for the platforms, they get added to an appropriations bill right before winter break. And nobody notices till it's signed. So, I mean, that's something that could happen as well. But I do think that there is this idea, just like other tech legislation, there's been this big push for privacy legislation, which I think would be wonderful. But that's kind of stalled as well, because there are so many priorities, there's so little time, there's an election next year. So I think that might be one thing they're counting on.
Do you think the debate has changed in the past, two, three-ish now years, I guess, since the 2016 election? I mean, there have always been social costs to free speech that we've been willing to abide, right? Whether it's individual attacks or, people saying horrible things. We have decided that the value of free speech is such that individual injury, as it were, will be tolerated in the name of a social good. Do you think it's changed now that the injury that's being done is to democracy in a lot of ways?
Yeah. So what's really interesting is Section 230 has really now two main vectors of criticism that really conflict with one another. From largely, I would say, the conservative side, the criticism has been that platforms are doing too much moderation. They're censoring people. And this criticism says that if you're not going to be this viewpoint neutral platform, you don't deserve Section 230 protection. Why are we providing this protection to platforms that will censor some voices? So that's the criticism from the right, that you're not, or that you're doing too much moderation. The criticism from the left and I think this really is because of the election, the 2016 election, is you are not doing nearly enough moderation, and you're being somehow protected by Section 230, and that's giving you a disincentive. So that's why when I say that moderation is hard, I think that's a really good example where you one side is saying we want to get rid of Section 230 because you're doing too much moderation. The other is saying you're not doing enough. Well, I mean, I think, frankly, what one thing that would be good is to figure out what is the adequate level of moderation that we want the platforms to be doing. And I think then going from there.
Mm-hmm. Well, no pressure. but you said you haven't heard a nuanced conversation. I think we're starting one. If you had a little prescription, you know, some layers that you might be, maybe 26 more words that we could add to Section 230, what might that start to look like?
Well, so I think that one, and this is where I think I fall somewhere in the middle of the anti and pro Section 230 folks. The real sort of diehard Section 230 folks will say no changes whatsoever. I would say that one big shortcoming is, so Section 230 has, and this is where we get really nerdy, so bear with me here. Section 230 has an exception for federal criminal law. So violations of federal criminal law have never been protected by Section 230. But Section 230 does protect platforms from state criminal law. The problem that we've had is that obviously, DOJ, FBI have limited resources, and states have really, in a lot of cases, like exploitation, for example, they've really taken the lead on a lot of these initiatives, yet they've not been able to go after really bad acting platforms. So I think that we could figure out some sort of limited carve out for Section 230 for state criminal enforcement. That would really go a long way in my mind of addressing what I've seen as some of the more problematic cases.
States' rights. Fascinating. Okay. Well, no, I mean, that's super interesting because we are definitely seeing the states, as you said, take a much stronger approach. Okay. That's nuanced. That's like a simple, you know, I feel like Kai is just dying to say that Congress can't find his backsides and whatever. This is good. This is going to help, though.
We can find an answer to this. Right?
Exactly the conversation that's going to help get us started. Jeff Kossoff is the author of The 26 Words That Created the Internet and a professor of cybersecurity law at the U.S. Naval Academy. Jeff, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
So, I still think it's a great interview. It holds up. It's really, really interesting and difficult and challenging. And honestly, for all the grief that I give Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey, to some extent, the guy who runs Twitter and the folks at Google, it's a really difficult problem. It's a legit, intractable problem.
It is profoundly difficult. And I have to say, I mean, so many people are becoming aware of Section 230 in ways both accurate and inaccurate.
Right. Important point.
Right. I mean, when you have Sacha Baron Cohen writing op-eds in the Washington Post saying, you know, Section 230 should go away because it gives these companies like complete immunity from any ever having to do anything about anything ever. And it's just like, okay, listen, like, say what you will about the economy that we have based on these companies and the companies that have been created as a result of these protections, like, you don't get Google search or DuckDuckGo search or Bing search. Like, you can't have accurate search results operated by a company without some version of Section 230. If a search engine could get sued out of existence every time something showed up that somebody didn't like, like, you don't have an organization of information fundamentally, let alone blogs or comments or all of the things that we take for granted in the internet economy today. And so people are coming at Section 230. I know I'm repeating a lot of things from the interview, but in ways that just don't, that betray a lack of understanding, shall we say.
What Molly said, this RT is an endorsement. Exactly.
Such a valuable conversation.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will hear what you think is going to happen in the new year. Predictions round 3 in a minute.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money.
I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
And we're back. And it is time.
Jazz hands.
Jazz hands. It's just such a good beat drop. I love it. Good. I get all excited. Now it is time for you, the listeners, to give us your predictions.
But, and let me say this in my own defense, because I was the guy who agitated for voice memos because I just did because it's audio. We know we're doing that, but we also know that it's a little pain in the tushy for some of you. So, send us an email or a Facebook comment. We'll get it on the pod. That's fine. Not everybody is as obsessed with audio, even though I can't speak, as we are. So we're doing it the old-fashioned way this time, reading your predictions off a plain old computer screen. So there you go.
That's right.
Yes.
And here is the first one. By the way, I'm going to find a link to it because that beat drop thing made me think of this amazing thing that I saw on TikTok, which is that somebody did timing for all these like really popular songs that was basically like if you start, Post Malone's Sunflower at 11:59 and 32 seconds or Panic at the Disco, that then the beat drop happens right at midnight.
Yes.
And he did it for like six songs. It's actually pretty awesome. Okay, sorry. Back to
it's cool. To you guys. It's cool.
But
it's
cool. Very New Year's related.
Yes.
Here's the first one. Kevin Lee Caster on Twitter writes, oil will dip below and stay below $40 a barrel by the end of 2020 as electric vehicles take off and new models become available.
Strong disagree. Too soon. Perhaps eventually, but not this year.
Pretty soon, but earlier in December, Mercedes delayed the release of their electric SUV because the ones from Jaguar and Audi haven't been selling that well. Now, it could be because they start at like 70 or 80 grand, but still.
Yeah. Also, oil's at like 55 now. I don't think it's getting to 40, but we'll see. We'll see. We'll do this again in a year, and maybe Kevin was right.
Yep. Kyle Wilcox on Facebook writes, I predict that Kai and Molly have a serious discussion of universal basic income in 2020. Make Me Smart has done more episodes on income inequality than any other topic, but UBI has never been brought up. I know. Well, I think we're like scarred. We had one episode totally fall apart or something.
Yeah, there was that. Also, on Marketplace, we've done UBI a couple of times. What we ought to do is get Annie Lowry on sort of early springish next year, right? She just wrote a book. She writes for, who's she writing for now? The Atlantic Times? I don't even know. But she wrote a whole book about it. So, yeah, I mean, UBI is real. The prospects of it becoming real are far murkier.
Yes, but we can discuss.
Sure. All right. On Twitter, Bobcat Arts is the handle. He writes, or she perhaps writes, somebody, probably Tesla, will unveil truck-sized autonomous cargo pods that will claim to disrupt shipping. Think a small shed with four wheels that steers in any direction where you can load 4 to 5 on a semi-truck for super long hauls. It's an advance in containerized shipping. I don't know about the autonomous part. I mean, cargo pods are there already. Think about an airplane, right?
I could see that. I mean, that's not that different from delivery drones, which are way scarier on site. Or delivery, there's all these little delivery bots now that are basically a Wally-shaped box.
Yep.
This is just that for trucking? Okay. Endorse.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Jody Pritchard on Facebook wrote this. If the Democratic nominee wins, Trump and the Republicans claim election fraud with no sense of irony or make up some rule that allows him to stay in office. I don't know about the last part, but certainly I think if President Trump wins or loses, there will be claims of election fraud for sure. I mean, he won and there's claims of election fraud. So, misguided and fake, right? Because let me just say this. There is no zero in-person election fraud in this country, full stop.
Right. That does not mean that some Republicans have not floated the concept of third term for President Trump. Yeah. And so, look out. Mark Lush on Facebook says, a bunch of economists will predict an economic slowdown. Those same economists will be proven wrong. Those same economists won't be held accountable for their poor predictions and will be allowed to make more inaccurate predictions.
Or as we like to say around here, Tuesday. I mean, that has already come true. That has already come true.
And a bunch of the same people who basically allowed the conditions that led to the financial, to the Great Depression are still on TV saying all the same stuff.
Or in the White House working as the director of the National Economic Council.
There you go.
For
we don't do accountable
example. No.
Super great here in America.
Here's Todd Schultz on Facebook, quote, "My brain says to expect worse in 2020 with a continued societal drift away from trust in science, but my heart is hopeful for a reactive shift backward toward more people working for the common good." Amen.
Yes.
Fingers crossed. That's
both of those things.
Yes.
Without a doubt.
Yep.
Equal and opposite reactions.
Yes.
Yep.
There we go.
It's real.
So
just cling to the good side.
Speaking of accountability, we're gonna spin this again next December, and we're going to see how all y'all did. And, you know, we'll see what happens. But
in
the
meanwhile, audio lasts forever.
No, that's right. On the way out, let me give the newsletter plug again. Lands in your inbox every Friday morning. Covers some of the highlights of the week. Great recommendations from you, the listeners. Also, our staff here. Marketplace.org/newsletters to sign up, please.
Yes.
Please.
Please. What he said. Please.
Oh, my goodness.
All right. There we go. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to our video producer, Ben Heathcoat, and to Erica Phillips, who writes our newsletter and our Amazon-related Echo device skill.
This week's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday. Our theme music was composed by Ben and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And that's what we got. Yeah. Oh.
Oh, and that's that. The end.
We'll fix it in post. All right, everybody.
We're
good? Oh, my goodness. That was pretty funny. All right.
Incredible.
Bye.
All right. Thank you.
Woo.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.